And I'm Joel.
And this is Sunday School Cinema. Hooray!
We're a week late again. We're off schedule again already, but I guess a week isn't too bad for us.
I mean, depending on when I edit it, we might still be on schedule. People might not notice. It's more for me.
I don't think people would notice anyway. But happy St. Paddy's Day, by the way. I think that's today.
It is today. I learned this from Twitter.
We should watch an Irish movie. What are we doing with this thing?
I don't think we have an Irish movie.
Yeah, maybe not. Okay.
At least not one we haven't. We've watched a couple, I think, based in Ireland, but we've already watched them.
Right. Well, yeah, we've had a couple. Yeah. And I can think of a few others that would have been really good for this, but I think I saw them after. So, like, Calvary would have been an obvious choice for this if it had come out before. But I saw that while I was in Portland, so it must come out later.
Indeed. Anyway, many movies we're not watching today, but the movie we did watch today, or watch for today, was the 2001 film In the Bedroom.
Right, Todd Field, who most recently did Tar, which of course got a whole bunch of attention and awards and such last year. But he is I guess he's only done three features. This was his first, and then in 06 he did Little Children, which was also a good but quite troubling movie. And then last year he finally got to do another one and did Tar. I don't know if he's one of those people who just doesn't, maybe he does other things, or maybe he just has trouble finding funding. I don't know, but
yeah, I'm not.
He has yet to do a not fascinating movie, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think I saw this one, well, it came out in 2001, so I guess I would have been 17. I was thinking I'd see it in theaters, but that can't be true if I was 17. I don't think I went to go see hardly any R-rated movies in theaters. I must have rented it later. And then I was a huge fan of Little Children when it came out. I haven't watched that one in years. I love Tar, so, you know.
Yeah, so this one... First movie got 5 Oscar nominations. Did it get any wins?
I don't think so.
I don't think it did. But this was Tom Wilkinson, of course, who sadly passed away a few months ago. But this was kind of his big calling card, I think, as an actor. Like, I don't know if he got started late in his career. I feel like I've never seen him young late in his career, late in his life. I feel like I've never seen him, like, younger than this. But that... doesn't seem right. Maybe he was just doing like British TV stuff or something. I don't know. But yeah, he got an Oscar nomination for this. He ended up having at least 2 because he got nominated for Michael Clayton as well, I think. But he was a hell of an actor and definitely quite a loss having him gone. So it was interesting to revisit this, you know, one of his first big attention-getting performances, and he is really great. Like, and him and Sissy Spacek, who of course is also a legendary actress, have a lot of really great stuff together.
Yeah, it looks like he had 130 acting credits, and it does appear that he, like, his earliest credits, well, his very earliest credits are, like, in the 70s. It does look like a lot of TV, British stuff. He was in a Miss Marple thing, that sort of thing. He was definitely active for a long time, but I agree, I can't think, and looking at this, it looks like the earliest thing that I would have seen him in was in The Name of the Father, but I don't remember, and that was in 93, and I don't remember that movie at all.
Irish movies.
He was also in Priest, which was a movie I really, really liked when I watched his. It had fucking Jesus.
I think I saw that. I don't remember him in it.
He's like second build. He's one of the priests. I mean, not the main priest, I don't believe, but one of the other priests. And anyway, it's a movie about a gay priest who somebody confesses abusing a child to, and he has to decide. Anyway, I don't know how I'd feel about it now, but I liked it. But yeah, he's been around, but I agree. I don't feel like I was, like, presently aware of him for a really long time.
So, this is I think we probably agree it's a really good movie. It's a very sad movie. It is almost an overwhelmingly sad movie for a while, I think.
It didn't hit me like it did then. I actually dropped my rating half a star. I think, like, it's beautiful, gorgeously filmed, and obviously the acting is very good, like, you know. But I just, like, I don't know if I was just in a weird frame of mind or what, but, like, I didn't find myself that, like, emotionally connected.
I kept thinking about Manchester by the Sea while I was watching it for, like, fairly obvious surface reasons, I guess. But, and it's not as sad as Manchester by the Sea, which might be the saddest movie I've ever seen in my life. But it has a very similar setting, and, you know, it has similar themes. Parental loss of children and, you know, just, like, sad people trying to cope with the sad things that have happened to them. But yeah, it's set in like a, you know, like small town, like a fishing town in Maine. And it has very like, there's a lot of it that is clearly like just shot with local people, and, you know, it has a very good, like, sort of sense of place you know, a lot of stuff like out on fishing boats and stuff like that, which I really enjoyed all of that. It's all very well done. I did think it was kind of interesting that Sissy Spacek's character is a conductor like Tar. there's this really beautiful recurring piece of music throughout the movie because she's preparing this like a concert of this was it. I can't remember what part of some Eastern European, like, folk music, choral music. So we see a bunch of sequences of them rehearsing that, and it's a really kind of incredible piece of music. I need to look that up and see if I can find a full recording of it, because it's really beautiful. But I did think that was kind of a funny. Every time it showed up, I was like, oh, I wonder if this is first what got him thinking about, you know, conductors. As probably not, but I did think it was funny.
You never know. So, yeah, I mean, it is certainly like a sad. I hadn't remembered a lot of the details of the story. It's a small story in a lot of ways. It is essentially this, the Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek have an adult son, I would guess in his early 20s, who I think, because I think he's graduated undergrad and is like the considered.
Yeah, he's supposed to be heading off to grad school to architecture, I think. I don't think it ever actually said that, but that was what I gathered, or engineering or something like that.
I mean, presumably architecture, because he was talking about whoever it was that had invented this way of looking at a house and, like, yeah, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, architecture, presumably. But he's home for the summer. I guess before he's supposed to go off to school, which is very confusing because, and this is neither here nor there, but at some point they're like, what about the interview for school? Has he not been, he has to have been accepted if he's supposed to leave in the fall. And the interview, I was very confused by that.
I thought so, yeah. I was a little bit thrown by that too, actually, because they mentioned the interview and I assumed it was like a job interview, but then it clearly wasn't. So I don't know if it's something about getting into like a specific program, because there was a scene later where he's like talking on the phone with a guy that was going to be like his teacher, and maybe it had something to do with getting into like specifically into that guy's program. I don't know.
That's true.
I don't know how any of that stuff works.
Maybe it was like an internship thing, although it seems weird to be trying to get your internship before you get into the school, but maybe it's different in architecture. I don't have that background. So, but during the summer, he has been dating this woman who is older, probably in her 30s, played by Marissa Tomei, who has two children who are like maybe like 6 and 8 or something like that, you know, that general age. And he's really been getting, I had a lot of credit because I was like, did you go into this initially thinking that this was going to be like, like chill fling, and if so, why the fuck are you hanging out with her children so much? That's not cool.
Yeah, I well, see, I had a little bit of wondering about that too early on. Like, is it pure bullshit? Him telling his mom like we're not serious. Is it just a casual thing? Is he just telling her that to get her off his back, or was that actually what he thought was happening early on? But by the time the movie starts, he's like in the family. Like he's like taken her kids out to go fishing with him and stuff. Like he's in with the kids and they really love him, and like it is clearly not, I mean, it is clearly progressed past the point where if he just left it would be like a huge blow to this family, and it's a little bit unclear to me at least how aware of that he is, at least early on.
It is honestly never like, also I don't it annoyed me. I don't feel like anyone talked about it that much. Like there was this general concept of like his parents are upset at the idea that like what if he like doesn't go to school and continue and do all of these things. But like even I don't even think Sissy Spacek ever says anything about like you're gonna fuck these children up. Marissa Tomei doesn't seem to be thinking twice about it. I was like, why is no one concerned about these children?
Yeah, we don't get a lot of insight into Marissa Tomei's character, I guess. And like she's clearly in love with him, like that's but then, you know, his parents are talking about that, like that's girls have always been in love with him, like he's, you know, he's dated a lot of women, they're always in love with him, and like it's never been a big deal. And that's what, you know, his father tries to kind of shrug it off as it'll be fine, it's not that big of a deal, this is the kind of thing that happens with him. But it's true that it doesn't. So yeah, I don't know. She doesn't seem to think he's going to be staying. She's like, he even mentions to her like, maybe I'll put off going to school for a year, and she's like, you can't do that. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what she's doing, getting her kids that involved with him as a weird choice. But you know, people make dumb choices. Like that's she was like a very troubled person, had been in this abusive marriage, which is central to the plot here. She has this sort of soon to be ex husband that is like very aggressive. Dude that is hanging around, you know, trying to get his kids on his side and trying to scare off the new boyfriend. And, you know, people make dumb choices, and maybe that's all it is in this case.
No, I mean, I don't disagree, but what's confusing to me is that no one else, like her, I'm like, okay, people do make dumb choices. She's clearly like trying to extricate herself from this very dramatic thing, and the idea of like, and I can even see how she could like, you know, justify it to herself to some extent of being like, you know, well, the kids will get to have a stable presence during this. I can see all of that. But like Sissy Spacek, who is so upset about the relationship to begin with, never see like throws a birthday party for one of the children. Like they're very like, I don't know. It bothered me because it felt like no one was that worried about the children. And I was like very bothered by that. But regardless, I mean, like Sissy Spacek has one line to him where she says something like, this isn't like a Vassar girl that you can just, but it's unclear how much of that is about like, you're going to damage the kids. It bothered me.
I think her bigger concern was that he was going to do exactly what he almost does, which is he's going to fall for this woman and he's going to give up on his big life plans. And he's just going to stay here in this small town and fish for the rest of his life. I think that is clearly her larger concern.
100%. And she like, and you know, part of the thing here, of course, is that her and her husband never had any other children. So it's like this one kid and like all of the hopes and dreams that they have are like pinned on this one child. And, you know, he definitely seems to have like a complicated relationship with his mother. And like his father is like a lot more chill, but also like doesn't like, I don't know. There's a very brutal scene later in the movie where they are both like saying awful things to each other. And like, I think they're probably both right to some extent. But regardless, so he's considering staying. I forgot how much of the movie happened before the like in Central.
Well, yeah, me too. Cause that is the plot pitch of the movie that I remember hearing. And that I feel like what you hear is that what ends up happening is that their son gets murdered by this ex-husband. He comes and smashes up the house and the son goes over there to, is it Frank? Was that his name? Goes over to, you know, help however he can. And the guy comes back and ends up shooting him. And that is, I feel like that is what people talk about. You know, it's about these parents dealing with their son being murdered and stuff. But that is essentially like the end of act two that happens. It really is. There's a lot of movie before that, which I think was a good choice. Like, you know, a lot of time with the characters and time in the setting and stuff.
Well, and again, I mean, it is in a lot of what, you know, it's this small story in this small town with like, and like, I think that like, you probably need like the rhythms of all of that to like get a true sense of what it's like. I don't know. I mean, Tom Wilkinson is a doctor in town, in this small town, like taking care of people, doing his thing, but he loves to fish and he like comes out and, you know, fishes with his kid regularly during the day. And, you know, he's fishing over the summer. And like Joel said, like at some point Frank starts being like, well, maybe I just want to stay here. Maybe this is like an okay life. Like, why is this so bad? And
right. If this life that you're pushing me towards is so great, then why are you always out here sneaking out here to come fishing with me? There is a bit of that. Like, it seems like maybe Wilkinson's character is kind of jealous of this possible life that he sees his son going into, like that, you know, maybe he didn't want the path that he's on, but he got pushed into it. It never really goes into detail about that, but that is kind of the sense of it.
Yeah, excuse me. I think so. And there's this whole thing. Like he has this best friend. There's a weird thing at the birthday party earlier, where like his best friend, no, his name is Matt. I can't remember what the best friend's name is, but is ogling Marissa Tomei in like kind of a gross way, and like they're kind of talking about, you know, when they were younger. So yeah, I mean, I think, and she says this much more explicitly later after he dies, the idea that like you were like living out your life, like, you know, sort of through your son who got to sleep with this gorgeous woman and who got to like all of these things. But like the thing is, like, she was doing the same thing, right? Like, they, again, all of their hopes and dreams and like the things that they didn't get to do or that they whatever are all in this one kid because they didn't have others.
Yeah, the friend, is his name is Willis. He's played by an actor named William Wise, who I didn't recognize, and he only has like a dozen film credits, but he was really good. I was very impressed with him. It's one of those. It's always weird to me to see a movie where there's like an older character actor that like really stands out as good that I've never seen before. Like, that's such a rare thing these days, because we've watched so many movies from back through the decades, but he was quite good. I was very impressed with that character.
Anyway, the ex-husband, soon to be ex-husband, keeps showing up like increasingly violent things. At some point he like punches the kid in the face, and then yeah, at some point he like tears up the whole house. And I think the son gets a call from one of the children. It sounded like he was talking to the kid.
I believe so. And this, like, he had broken up with her. That, like, his parents had talked him into it. He had broken up with her. He was going to go off to school. And then he gets a call from one of her sons. And so he runs over there, and the whole house is smashed up and all of that.
Which, again, leads back to the fact that this child is... anyway, and the house is all smashed up, and he's like, we have to call the police, which they haven't done previously. When he got attacked by the guy, they didn't call the police. I mean, I'm not convinced it would have mattered, but regardless, like, Sissy Spacek wanted them to call the police, and he was like, no, they're just going to go over there, and they're going to scare the kids, they're asleep, like, you know, whatever. And Tom Wilkinson ended up kind of siding with him, and like, so, yeah, he's like, okay, we have to call the police now. And she's like, I don't know what I want to do. And then the guy comes back and he sends them up to the bedroom to like hide, and is like, I'm gonna get rid of him, sort of thing. But he came with a gun. We hear a gunshot. We don't actually see we see her coming down the stairs and seeing him dead on the floor, and the guy like having sat himself down at the table and just kind of sitting there. And so he's dead, and not only is he dead, but it would appear that the legal system isn't going to do that much about it, because unfortunately, when they first took her statement, traumatized, in shock, all of these things, she said that she had seen the gun go off, which she did not. And that comes out in the trial, which is not great for the, you know, and the guy's claiming that there was a struggle and it happened, and like, they can't prove otherwise. So like, so now it's looking like he's going to get like essentially a few years for manslaughter.
Right. Well, it's all of that combined with the fact that he is the son of the guy who owns the seafood processing plant in town, like the guy who owns the town, basically. So he's got connections, he's got fancy lawyers, who one of the only one that we really see is played by Karen Allen in that one courtroom scene, which is the only scene she has in the movie, which, like, I felt like they must have cut more of her character or something, because why would you bring her in to do one scene? She's a really good actress, and I was like, I do not remember her in this movie. That's weird. I always like seeing her, but she only had the one scene. But yeah, so he's, you know, basically, even, you know, their lawyers are telling him, like, it's almost certainly going to get downgraded to manslaughter. 5 to 15 years, he might do 7. Like, it's just not, it's, you know, it's going to end up being a slap on the wrist kind of situation. And in the meantime, he got bail, so he's out, and he is living in this small town with them, you know, so they keep bumping into him in the grocery store and shit like that. I mean,
and he's like, he doesn't have any, like, he smiles at her once. Like, there's no sense of, like, shame around. But he's, like, wandering around with other women. He's, like, you know, he's doing all this stuff.
Sure. He was the rich kid who grew up as the son of the king of the town. And he's in his mid-30s now, but he still has that attitude. Like, there's a scene where the friend Willis is talking to Matt, and he tells him, like, my kids went to high school with this kid, and I fucking hated him then. He was exactly like this then, and he hasn't gotten any better. Like, that's just the, you know, he was the rich kid who thought he was above all of the concerns of lesser people.
Yeah, and you know, no evidence that he's doing anything with his children, his poor children, who we don't see a lot of. Once at some point Tom Wilkinson is out fishing and like comes back or is on the docks or something and sees one of the kids there watching him, but doesn't say anything to him. Marissa Tomei and Tom Wilkinson have a conversation at some point where he's kind of trying to, but like, I don't know. The point is that these two grieving parents are grieving in really separate ways and really not like able to come together. So they kind of just like go on living their lives like normal, but seeing each other less. And obviously their dynamic has changed. Like what we saw before was them very like loving and playful in a lot of ways and stuff. And now it's just sort of like, you know, she just sits in the house chain smoking all day and he's, you know, suddenly having to fix things at the office or whatever and go to, you know, sort of be anywhere but home. And I don't know, she has like, you know, so they've got all these friends. They go up for like a weekend with Willis and his wife. And like, you know, the woman starts talking about like the grandkids and she's like, how, and like Sissy Spacek does do an incredible job at just like at this.
She's so good in this. Like everyone talks about Wilkinson still and rightfully so, but she's great in this.
Well, because her, like, it's so restrained as a performance. Like, it's just like these, you know, we know that she's like dying inside, but like, it's not anyway. And this woman,
a lot of it really is, it's one of those all in the eyes kind of performances, which I feel like everyone goes nuts for with men, but tend to notice less when it's a woman doing it. But
agreed. And like this woman starts telling him about their grandkids. And at some point she's just like, how many grandkids do you have? And she has to count, like she can't remember off the top of her head. And I think she comes up with 11 or 14 or something. And then she, like, this other woman just like breaks down. It's like, I'm so sorry. I'm so, like, cause then she says that like Willis says, at least we'll never die out. And then she like realizes that that's an insane, awful thing to say. And is like, I'm so sorry. And Sissy again doesn't cry or anything in that moment. It's just like, you know, we wanted to, like, I wanted to have more. It just didn't make sense and it just never happened. And like, and so there is this like sense where people keep trying to sort of like at one point the priest tries to comfort her with like this story. And like, it's like, but he was their only one. And it was clear that that's unusual in the town. That's not what most people have. And it's certainly not like, it would not be absolutely devastating to lose a child if you also have others. But for her in particular, this feeling of like, all of their hopes and dreams are just gone with this kid.
Well, right. And of course, the specific circumstances all make it worse, too, that it's the situation that, like, she feels like she should have pushed harder to get him away from this situation. And, you know, and of course, the fact that the guy is still around. And so she's got this constant reminder of it. And it's all just like it, another movie that it reminded me of that I kept thinking of was that Dear Zachary. Which is another, maybe the second saddest movie I've ever seen. It was a great documentary that you might need a week to recover from if you watch it. But also about, you know, a son who was murdered in that case by his partner. I believe, if I remember right, it's been a long time since I've watched it. But anyway, a lot of it reminded me of that movie as well.
Yeah, I can see that. I wouldn't have. Yeah. Whew, that was a rough one.
Yeah, try not to think about that movie too often because it is. Yeah, that's tough.
Did you go into that one blind? I went into it totally blind. I had no idea. I mean, I knew like the central premise, and I'm not going to spoil it here in case someone does decide that they want to go devastate their lives for a week. But like, because it is genuinely an incredible, incredible documentary. But I did not know about the later stuff in the movie that happened.
I don't remember if I did or not. It's been a long time since I watched it. So. Yeah, I don't recall.
Anyway, brutal. But so for a long time, they're sort of back and forth. And then they do have this sort of like central fight that I imagine. I don't remember. I probably didn't watch the Oscars that year, but I assume it was what was on the Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's the two of them at like peak form and it's so well shot. And it's one of those where you're just like, please stop. You're going to like, you're going to say things to each other here that you're never going to be able to take back. But also like, maybe it's all stuff that kind of needs to be said. And, you know, it's just incredibly well put together.
Yeah. Essentially they're, she at first sort of blames him or like accuses him of like never, you know, again, of this sort of like, you're jealous of this life that your kid got to lead. And now he's dead because you didn't push. He would have listened to you. He didn't listen to me. And eventually he does fight back and is like, you know, he wouldn't listen to you because you are so controlling and so terrible. And, you know, all of these things. And I can't talk to you because I'm like afraid of you. You're so bitter and angry. It's just, it's awful. It's awful. And it's worse almost like they are yelling sometimes, but sometimes they're not, especially Tom Wilkinson. Johnson is often just like saying these things, these just like awful things. And then the door, and then someone knocks at the door and it's a child selling candy. He like buys a bunch of candy bars and then comes back in and they apologize or whatever. And that's when she tells him that she's been seeing it, 'cause he hasn't seen the guy, but she has seen him in multiple locations around town and hasn't told him. And I guess that's when they decide that something has to be done.
Right. So that's kind of the last bit of the movie is Wilkinson finds the guy at work and essentially kidnaps him and takes him back to his house and makes him pack, tells him that he just needs him out of town so that his wife will stop seeing him around, and tells him that he bought him a train ticket, he's sending him away, but, you know, takes him out to his friend's cabin and shoots him and buries him out in the woods.
With the help of his friend.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, then he goes home and strips off all his clothes and... If I recall correctly, we don't know until the very end whether his wife was aware of the plan, right? But he goes home and finds her in bed, and you know, she's just like, did you do it? And it kind of leaves on that, because like as they're driving back, they're like, well, we're running late here. People saw us. I don't know if our alibi is going to hold up anymore. But there's nothing they can do about it, so they just go home, and the movie kind of ends without resolving any of that, which is interesting. It leaves it open ended. We don't know if they got away with it, quote unquote. But it's, I think that was a good interesting choice.
They also like he shoots like they are late because he shoots him before he was supposed to. Like
right, they were supposed to bring him out into the woods and shoot him there, but he is impatient and just shoots him in the driveway.
Yeah, he says something like, I didn't want to wait anymore or something. Anyway, and so they end up, having to wait for this bridge crossing that has to be open for these boats going out to fish. So the ferry guy, there's like this little shot of the ferry guy just like staring at them. Well, so yeah, like it's unclear. And I don't know what they did with his truck. Because what about his car? Like they said,
yeah, they drove it out there, but I don't know what they ended up doing with it. I assume they had. I mean, they clearly had this whole thing pretty meticulously planned out. So I assume they had something in mind for it, but I don't think it shows.
But yeah, and then yeah, he comes home. He strips off all his clothes. He puts them on the washer, but does not wash them, which I thought was a really funny note because like probably the man has never washed his clothes in his adult life, and that's what his wife does.
It just occurred to me, probably what they did with his car was they probably left it at the train station, because he also left like a slip for a train ticket behind in his apartment, and they're trying to make it look like he left town, right? So I'm sure they parked his car at the train station and left it there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, and so then he goes up and lays down, and she asks him if it's done, and he says something about there was a picture of her, the two of them, on his bathroom wall, and she was like... And what about it? And he was like, I don't know, something about the way she was smiling. And she was like, what? And he says, I don't know. And it's, you know, it's one of these things where it's like, even if they do get away with it, like there's nothing is fixed or resolved. This isn't actually going to. And I was thinking about this while I was watching, because I was like, I feel like there are several movies that we watch that could fall into this type of category, where essentially at the time, what was interesting to me was like, is it okay to kill someone ever? Like, I feel like, or like to do whatever. I feel like Gone Baby Gone had like similar, like these, like where we were like busy sort of pushing at the boundaries of some of these things and being like, okay, but like we've been taught this in this super black and white way, but like, is it?
Right. It was very like ethics class 101 kind of like, yeah, you don't want to kill people, but what if it's a more complicated situation, then can you kill people? Yeah.
Well, and I mean, like, you know, to be clear, Christians are totally fine with killing certain people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They just prefer if you know, the prison guards do it.
Or, like, at least not the good white people. Like, and so I think, honestly, in a lot of ways, like, when I look at some of these movies, a lot of which I do, and I do think this is a good movie. I don't know why it didn't strike me as hard this time, but... Like, in a lot of ways, when I look, I'm like, this is like stuff we should have been figuring out in like junior high school, but like we like did, like that's sort of the core of these questions, is like, you know, sophomore year like class on ethics. Like, what does this look like? And we were kind of trying to feel it out on our own, using movies, which is how we learned basically everything. And I don't have any memory of how Dad and Chuck responded to this.
Yeah, I don't either.
Like, honestly, it feels like too ethically complex of a film for a father to have appreciated. I look at it now and I'm like, what was it that you were hoping to like get from Dad or from whatever, like in this context? Sometimes I can look at it and I know exactly what it was I was hoping to get, but at this point it just feels like I was being like, okay, but like, what about this one?
Right.
This one.
You know, yeah, as I think we've detailed before, but a lot of what ended up being kind of our goal with this whole group was to like poke certain ideas at Dad to see how he would respond. That I don't know that that was kind of, I don't think we ever talked about it in those terms, and I don't know that that was even necessarily our goal when we decided to start this thing, but I think that ended up being a lot of what it was.
I don't know if we knew that was our goal. Like, I think that, like, at this point, things were really different, but it was normal for us to like, push different things at Dad, you know? Like, because Dad was the one who, like, he loves a discussion.
Right. He enjoyed those conversations. Yeah. And if, you know, I don't think we ever changed his mind about anything, but he enjoyed having the conversations.
Nothing substantial. I think that part of what was like a bitch about Dad is that like he will change like surface level stuff. And so it really feels like he's listening, but there's this core thing that you never actually can touch. And so I think at that point, this was really common in various ways, like, you know, like how I had Dad read Blue Like Jazz and like some of the, you know, like trying to like, I was constantly at this point, I was living on my own and I, you know, I would do like, you know, Dad like trade books and like, or we read about the Emergent Church for a while, like various things like that, where I was trying to like get through to him in some way. Whereas Mom, we would never, ever, ever talk about this stuff with, cause like, what was the point? She would just lose her fucking mind. But I do it because it was Dad and Chuck and then everyone else. And that was functionally what it ended up being. Like, we did not have a lot of conversation that I recall, like, of disagreement between, like, the millennial side of the room.
Yeah, not that I remember either. It's not beyond, like, whether we like the movie or not, because there was some disagreement about that sometimes. But, yeah, as far as the bigger questions, I don't remember having any arguments between the younger folks.
No, I think it just ended up being sort of like millennials versus Dad and Chuck, both of whom, in a way that I now find really gross, seem to, like, I think at least Chuck, if not Dad, saw this as like an opportunity to like give forth their wisdom to the younger generation, and like in a way that I find so gross for a number of reasons at this point. It was a weird thing, this group that we ran, but it is not like that much of an exaggeration in retrospect to be like, we did in fact create an entire small group that like 5 to 10 people attended per week specifically to try to make our father think about something.
I think that was a huge part of it. And that was, you know, when we started this podcast, a big part of the thought behind it was that we would kind of like revisit some of those conversations. But as it's turned out, we just don't remember most of them very, very well. There's only been a few examples where we could really call to mind specific things that came up. And I don't remember anything from this one. So,
well, and the thing is that like, I think that I genuinely, looking back at that, I find it very like sad and sweet. Like, it's like we are being earnest and really trying to like engage in some way, and Dad is like, this is my opportunity to like provide, like, he's not hearing, you know, like he's listening but he's not hearing.
Well, and big picture, I mean, it was essentially the same conversation over and over again, right? Like, there were variations on the specifics, but the general themes were the same thing over and over again. And yeah, I don't think we ever made any progress there, but
no, I don't think we did either, but I don't think we made progress with Dad. I think that, to be clear, I don't want to make it sound like I regret doing these things, because
I think it was good for us to have those discussions and be watching these movies. I mean, just like, I think it's good for us to be watching good movies now. Like, that's always a good thing for people. And I don't think it did Dad any harm either. He definitely watched some stuff because of this group that he never would have watched without it. And I think that's a good thing. I don't know how much of it sank in, if any of it, but I always think it's good to to be showing people things like this that they wouldn't normally watch.
No, I totally agree with that. And I also think for me, I'm not going to speak for you, but for me, I think that there was like a number of conversations that I had to go through and see with him before I could like accept that like nothing was going to change. Like, and I think, and that was for me, I think a huge part, like it wasn't like an immediate part. I wouldn't cut them off for another few years at least, 3 or 4 years maybe. But like, I think that having that consistent sort of like beating our head into a wall, like I had to do it. I had to feel like I had tried everything that I could possibly try before I could like come to what was the healthiest decision I could have made. But it took years to get there, and it might have taken longer if we had done this year where we were doing this all the time. Like, I think that it is unfortunate that he wasn't capable of like engaging with that in the way that he should have. But I do think it was good for us overall. Anyway, I don't know that I have that much else to say about the movie. I was just pondering it a lot while thinking about like why I chose this movie and like where we were at that point.
You know, one thing that struck me about the movie, we talked about this scene with the big sort of fight between them, and they're kind of going back and forth on like, you know, Wilkinson is telling, like, you think our son died because I was too lenient on him, but the real reason why he died was because you were so hard on him, and like this is kind of the gist of the conversation going back and forth. And I found so their son, played by Nick Stahl, I don't think we've said that, he was one of those actors who was like, he was sort of on the verge of stardom for a few years around this time. He played John Connor in the third Terminator movie, and he had a couple other like sort of big things, but his career clearly didn't take off. I don't know that he's even still working. I haven't seen him in anything recently, but he's good in this. He's quite good. And you know, he's, as we talked about, he's like young and still like figuring his shit out, and maybe making some not great choices without being aware of it. But the thing that struck me about that conversation with the two of them going back and forth about this is why our son died is that like the real reason why their son died, that neither of them, I don't know if they're not aware of it, but they're certainly not saying it, is because like they raised him to be like a good, brave person who wanted to protect the people he loved. That like that was what got him killed. But that that's almost sadder for them to acknowledge that that's actually the reason why he died.
I really like that. That's a good note to point out, because I think it's to some extent, it's like all of the things that we experience in life are in large ways like interpreted by us through the stories that we tell about those things. And it is sadder, but it's also like it's a worse view of the world, but a better view of themselves as parents in a way. Like it's like, you know, and I think true, like that they taught him to be this loving, compassionate person, and that is what led to his death. I think you're absolutely right. And like to tell that story would tell a better story about their marriage and about the life that they made, but it's a so much worse story about the world and everything outside of it.
And it's also a better story about their son, right? Like this is what kind of gets lost in this, is they're not even talking about what our son was like. They're blaming it all on each other. But it is right. It is a sadder story to say, you know, we did all these things right, and he turned out to be a good kid, and that's why he died. Like, that is ultimately harder to deal with than he died because you did something wrong, right? So, but that is the reality of it, and I think that's, like, no one ever says that in the movie, but that is the sort of underlying fact of it, that I don't know if they can't acknowledge, or maybe they genuinely don't see it, but it really struck me during that scene, and it's the kind of sort of subtle emotional note that I think is hard to pull off, but I think was done very well in this movie.
No, thank you for mentioning that. I hadn't thought of that, and it's a really beautiful point. I think it really speaks to like how, again, I've talked so much on this podcast about how much of our lives is like making meaning, but grief is like particularly strong in that way. Like, how do we make sense of a world that is senseless, where a horrible thing has happened, someone we love is gone, whatever it might be, and like, I get like to some extent you're choosing like, is it safer to believe in a world overall that is, you know, just or whatever it might be, or at least somewhat, or to believe that like the world, like that this good thing that you did is not rewarded in any way by the world. And it's that like lack of meaning that implies.
And yeah, not only is it not rewarded, it's punished. Like, yeah. So yeah, it is. it is exactly the kind of like super complicated ethical and emotional thing that this guy likes to fill his movies with, and I really hope that he makes more movies soon.
Yeah, 100%. No, that's regarding Nick Stahl, on a quick Google, it appears that he had a number of substance problems and went into rehab for a while, but he is still acting. He just did that Tiny Beautiful Things miniseries or whatever that was on Hulu with Catherine Hahn, I think. And some other, anyways, he's still acting. He took some time off for a couple of years to focus on his sobriety. It looks like he's married and has a couple of kids and has, yeah. So we wish him well, hopefully.
Yeah, good for him. Hopefully he'll be, we'll see him again.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, yeah. I think that from my end, that seems like a great note to end on, unless you had something else you wanted.
No. I think that wraps it up pretty well, I think.
Great. It is a good movie. It's available for rent in all the usual places. Obviously quite sad. So, you know, if you're feeling like diving into that, feel free. But yeah, I think we both do recommend it regardless. So. Okay, so I believe we have 23 movies remaining. So we're whittling away here. We're making it down.
Man, 23. All right. What's number 9?
Number 9 is Dead Man Walking.
Great. I own that one. That's easy.
I am.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. Like, I bought that a long time ago, and I haven't watched it since. I don't think I've watched it since we did it for this group. That movie was a big deal to me. That was one of those, like, really kind of helped me in changing some foundational beliefs. But I could see it landing very differently today, so we'll see.
I also didn't passionately hate looking at Sean Penn's face when I watched it then, so, like, there's that.
Well, exactly that. Obviously, Sean Penn is a huge part of why it might land quite differently now.
We'll talk about it more next time. This is not the movie that changed my mind on the death penalty, but it was a movie that did change my mind on the death penalty.
It was one of a couple different things that did it for me. It looks like it's rentable in all the usual places. So
cool. Well, we'll check that out then and have a fun conversation about the death penalty and maybe some of the cognitive dissonance of being raised to believe that life was precious, but the death penalty was absolutely crucial.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be a great Susan Sarandon performance, at least. We have that to look forward to.
No doubt. Okay. Well, hopefully what we've been watching will be a little less extensive than last time. Jesus Christ.
I mean, it has to be. I haven't really watched that much since we last recorded. So.
I've watched a number of things, but a lot of them were short films, so they don't count that much.
Okay, well, yeah, you'd better start this time then. I think I started last time.
Okay, so last time, yeah, we talked about the Dunes last time, right?
Yes, I think we'd seen them the night before.
Yes, I think that's correct. Okay, cool. So the next day after we recorded, we watched our next Criterion film, which was Alfred Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent. Have you seen Foreign Correspondent?
I have. Not recently. Like, it was one of those that, like, as I've talked about before, we watched a lot of Hitchcock movies when I was, like, a teenager. I think it was one of those. I have good associations with the name, but I don't remember anything specific.
It's like the year or two before World War II breaks out, or like when it's right about to break out, and this guy gets sent, Joel McRae, to be a foreign correspondent because the head of the newspaper is annoyed that none of his foreign correspondents are actually sending him anything from Europe. And while he's over there, he, like, you know, encounters a plot to pretend to kill an important peace person, and like he falls in love with a beautiful woman and whatever. I was startled. I did not expect it to end quite so rah-rah America, which was like puzzling. Like, it literally ends with them being like, America is the only hope left in the world.
Oh, yeah, democracy. Like 1940, right? Or 1941, probably right after we'd gotten into the war. Yeah. Was that the one that had that scene like towards the climax in the windmill? Where
yes.
He gets his jacket caught in the gears. That's like a visceral memory for me, is that scene of him trying to get out of his jacket when it's caught in these giant gears.
I actually think it's about halfway through the movie, but yes, it is. It is in there. It was a fun. It was an interesting movie. Also, it had as a side character, it had George Saunders as a man whose name was Scott Folliette with two F's, and both of them were not capitalized. This was an important thing. There was something about his parents when they immigrated, and like, I don't know. I don't even remember the explanation for it. The real point of the story is that I would watch George Sanders, like, listening to that man like slink his way through his lines is just, he's actually a good guy in this one, which is not that common for him, but like, I would watch him do anything. Just like, just listening to him is an absolute joy. So anyway, so we watched that, and that was pretty good. And then we went to go see, or then we watched the rest of the Oscar-nominated documentary shorts. So we watched The Island in Between, which is about an island that is in between, specifically Taiwan and the coast of China. And there's this, like, island in the middle. It was fine. I don't know. I felt like... It was one of those things that I actually wasn't sure if it was best suited for a short. I was actually like, there's a lot, maybe it is if you're like way more familiar with the like, you know, political outlook or whatever, but like, I'm not. So, and we watched The Barber of Little Rock, which I really liked. That is about this guy in Little Rock, Arkansas, this young black man who, well, not so young anymore, I guess, probably closer to my age, but, I don't know, his mom was a social worker. She died relatively young, and he's really taken it upon himself to try to like work on like racial equity in his city, in a number of ways, including that he runs, he had started out as a barber, and he runs like a school for like young folks to learn how to, you know, cut hair and be able to like support themselves that way. And he also runs, a People's Trust Bank that, essentially allows them to provide thousands of dollars in like short-term loans and grants and various things to help people stay on their feet and whatever. It's a beautiful, it's gorgeously shot. It looks beautiful, and it's very inspiring. It's a really lovely story, and it's like up on YouTube. You should watch it. And then the Nai Nai and Waipo, which is up on Disney, which is the final documentary one. It is done by Sean Wang, who I believe has his first full feature coming out soon. And this movie did make me excited to see. It's about his two grandmothers, his paternal and his maternal grandmother, live together. They've been living together for many years, and it's just kind of like about them and their lives. And it's very joyful and beautiful, and it's great. It's like 8 minutes. People should go watch it. It's a good time. then we proceeded to the next John McTiernan film. Or the next one that I hadn't seen anyway. Do you have things with certain movies where you're like the cover image of this movie is burned into your brain, even though you never saw it because we saw it so many.
Absolutely. Mostly horror movies. Occasionally there's one that has a sexy picture on it. So those are also mostly horror movies though. But I definitely have that. I think most people from our generation have that.
A lot of wandering around video stores. Do you remember the cover of the John McTiernan film Medicine Man by chance?
That is definitely familiar to me. I wouldn't guarantee that it was from seeing it on video shelves, but yeah, it's Sean Connery with a weird, goofy karate outfit.
I think it's supposed to be like a safari outfit, but close enough. So it's Sean Connery and Lorraine Bracco in a movie called Medicine Man from 1992. And it's about as awful as I imagined that you would think it would be from all of those things. It is, Lorraine Bracco is not a terrible actress, but you would not know that from this movie. It is truly one of the most insane performances I've ever seen. It's very definitely in the early 90s of like the rainforests are burning down, and like Sean Connery has been like out as like a scientist in the middle of a rainforest living with his tribe for like X amount of time, and like is on the verge of discovering a cure for cancer, just all the cancers, I guess, and is trying to figure, like, at some point he found it and he hasn't been able to figure out like what the exact combination of things was. Lorraine Bracco is there to like try to get him to come back, and then realizes what he's found and is trying to help him. Anyway, it's very stupid. It's pretty racist.
I mean, yeah, that figures from that setup.
It's just bad. It's very bad. And then we watch Godzilla King of Monsters, because we're making our way towards Godzilla X Kong, which I'm so excited about. Every time I see the poster of them running together like buddy cops in a movie, I'm just like, I am so here for this nonsense.
Yeah, no, it's delightful.
But it was fun. I enjoy Godzilla. It's not my favorite of the grouping, but it's, you know, whatever. Vera Farmiga. Vera Farmiga and Kyle Chandler in this one, and then Vera Farmiga is not in the next one, but Millie Bobby Brown is. Anyway, like, whatever, the people don't matter. There's a lot of really fun monster stuff. It really, like, Morgan is very excited to see the new one in theaters, because watching these ones, it's very apparent, like, how much more fun it will be to watch it in theaters. And then we watched the first Predator, because we're watching our way through all the Alien and Predator movies. I hadn't seen the first Predator in a minute.
It's also John McTiernan, isn't it?
Correct. Like, I don't understand. Like, it's fine. It's like there's some cool stuff in it for sure. I love the face of the Predator. I wanna hug his silly mandibles. I like them a lot. I spend a lot of time being like, why is it that every intense 80s action film, all of these men seem to want to be making out with each other all of the time, which, like, I do enjoy, but also, like, why?
I mean, it's the same thing with, like, 80s rock music. That was just in the air for some reason. I don't have a good explanation for it. I'm sure a lot's been written about it, but...
No doubt. Like, yeah, it's fine. I don't know. By the end, I'm pretty bored for the most part, and But then he takes off his face mask, and I got to see his silly, cuddly little mandibles, and I do enjoy that.
I've only ever actually seen the original Predator once. I remember really liking it, but...
It's fun. It's fun. Like, it's fun. It's fine. It has... what is his name? Carl Weathers, who recently passed away. Right.
Also just died, yeah.
And then we went to go see, at the Pickford, the first we saw the animated... short nominated films, and then we had a full 40 minutes or so before we went to go see the live action ones. sold out house, so it was good that we bought tickets in advance. Of the anime ones, I would say that it was an okay year. The first one is so cool, and the first one in the program, I don't know, it's not what won. Tragically, the one that won was the most boring one by far.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but bad things about the one that won, which is very funny. I haven't seen them.
It was so stupid. But the first one was called Our Uniform. And it was directed by a woman Yegene Mogadam, about an Iranian girl talking about, like, sort of her school memories. And the animation is so cool. Like, it is, like, a huge amount of it, of the 7 minutes or so, probably like 5 minutes of the 7 minutes or so, are set on clothes. She used physical clothes and then animated on top of them, and, like, did animation things like climbing up or unbuttoning things, and there's more things inside. Like, it's so cool. Like, it was very cool. I don't know where it's available right now. Probably somewhere. A lot of these are. I'll try to find it before I put it up. But, like, this is the one personally that I would recommend watching. Pachyderm was also really beautiful and sad and very subtle in a way that I was afraid it would not be. So that one was nice too. 95 Senses was pretty good. War is Over was terrible. Letter to a Pig, I felt like I didn't fully understand. And then they filled out the program with two additional ones, which they do sometimes with the animated ones, because they're usually very short. One of them was I'm Hip, was like a 5 minute thing by John Musker, and like just like an old school animation thing, and it was this cat dancing around getting hit by things. It was fun. It was a good time. But the one before that they're both, like, they were shortlisted for the nominees. The one before that was one called Wild Summon, which is a movie in which, like, or is a short in which, like, all of the surrounding stuff is not animated. They have animated, like, it's like this beautiful, it's like salmon, but what if salmon were horrifying little people-shaped creatures with awful mouths and goggles and looked like the most terrifying creatures you've ever seen? Do you think that would make you feel more sympathetic towards salmon? Because that was not the experience that I had, personally. So I found that one genuinely nightmare-inducing. Was baffled as to why. I mean, like, I guess the animation was good, but I was like, I actually went afterwards and looked it up to see if PETA was involved, because it felt like something they would do, but it doesn't seem like it. And then we went to go see the live actions, which for the most part were pretty underwhelming to me. There was one with David Oyelowo, and, like, I love David Oyelowo. I thought that short was pretty bad. One called Red, White, and Blue that had Amanda Stone? Yes. Brittany Snow, my bad. Brittany Snow, about this woman seeking an abortion. She lives in Arkansas, and there's sort of a twisty twist in there as well. I'm a sucker for, like, hard to access abortion stories. I it, brings up a lot of feels for me. So I did enjoy that one overall. There was a Swedish one or Norwegian maybe, called Night of Fortune that was pretty funny and sad and nice. And then there was Invincible, which, I did not cry. It was about a young boy who's like broken out of a rehab facility or something. And, I did not cry during the movie until the end when they were like, this child who died, this is based on a true story. And here's the actual picture of him and his sister. And that was upsetting. Anyway. So, and then we watched, Father of the Bride. The original, because Morgan's never seen it. And I don't know, we were having like a very exhausted sort of evening. And I was like, this is a fun movie to watch. And it is a fun movie to watch. And, you know, it's good.
But the original as in like the old, old one or like the first of the two Steve Martin ones?
The first of the two Steve Martin ones.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then we watched our next Criterion one, which was Wildlife, that Paul Dano directed film.
Yeah, I saw that one when that came out. Yeah, I remember liking it.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I didn't love it. I could definitely tell it was shot in Montana. Like at some point I was like, I'm pretty positive this is Montana. And I went and looked and it was, and I was pleased about that. I spent a lot of time wondering what our dad would have thought of it. Like how, because I feel like it is not exactly our father's story, but like there are a lot of like overlapping commonalities. And I do wonder what he would have thought of it, or what he would think of it. Anyway, then we watched The Last Action Hero, which is one of those movies that I never saw because we weren't allowed to see it when we were growing
That's
up.
Also John McTiernan, isn't it? I guess this is the... Yeah.
McTiernan is the one that is happening on Blank Check right now. Anyway, or one of the ones. So it was fun. It was more fun than I expected it to be, for sure. And I think if I had watched it at like 12 when it was intended to be watched, it probably would have changed my whole fucking life.
That's the kind of like, it's like a meta thing, right? I've never seen that one, but like he's like, the character is like a character from a movie within the movie or something?
Correct. And the kid spends a lot of the movie trying to convince Arnold Schwarzenegger that he is in a movie by doing a lot of things like everyone's phone numbers start with 555. And like, why? And I feel like if I had watched this when I was 12 or 13, it would have changed my whole fucking life because I would have never seen anything that like meta and cool. But I didn't. I watched it at 40 and I know all of these things. But it was still more fun than I expected it to be. So, and then we watched... So Barbara Streisand is also one the Blank Check has either very recently gone through or is currently going through. I'm gonna brave being canceled here. I don't like her. I don't think she's good. We watched Prince of Tides. Have you seen
it? I saw your review of that. I have never seen that movie. I don't know anything about it. That movie is one where the cover is one that I remember from seeing in video stores. It's like the two of them laying in bed together, right? Like I remember that picture. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, I remember seeing that, but I know nothing at all about the movie.
It is so bad. At one point, Eric messaged me the next morning and was like, I love it when I can tell that you watched a movie you really hated, because when I look on the activity on Letterboxd, you went through and liked all of the bad reviews that you could find, which is true.
I've never done that before. But I don't usually like other reviews on there. It's not a thing I do.
It is true. Well, because so many of the reviews were positive that I felt insane that I had to like start looking for the ones who agree. This story, and apparently the book is an incredible masterpiece. I'm not going to speak to that. I have never read the book, so I don't know. And apparently the movie changed the book quite substantially because fucking Barbara Streisand wanted to be like one of the lead characters, and most of the book takes place in the past and like a small portion of it takes place in like the present. So she shifted it so that it mostly took place in the present so that she could, or, you know, push for that. She is a psychiatrist in New York who has a patient who recently tried to kill herself and almost succeeded for like the second or third time. And she needs to find out more information so that she can help this patient. So this patient's brother comes to talk to her extensively. So
Oh man, this is like if someone wrote a movie specifically to annoy you.
I know. And then, of course, and well, they kind of are trying to like skate around because like she's not his therapist. She's just using it. But like she's clearly like his therapist. And then they fuck for a while because, of course, they do. Nick Nolte, again, made me feel insane. The number of reviews that were like, this is incredible performance from Nick Nolte. And I'm like, what are you talking about? This is the, I look at this and I'm like, okay, so Nick Nolte was always bad then, like always terrible. Also the number of people who were like, he was so hot. And I was like, what are you talking about?
I see that in reviews all the time. I think Nick Nolte can be a very good actor, but he's like a very specific actor and it definitely doesn't work in everything.
I hated him in this. He had like the most cartoonishly Southern accent that sort of like ebbed and flowed. He was like, I thought he was so awful. He looked like I literally, and it's fine. I understand that appearances are subjective, but I literally cannot fathom finding him attractive at any fucking millisecond. Like him and Babs, oh my God, it's so bad. And then like, there is like something of a story in there for a while where I was like, okay, like he had this abusive father, like this is his twin sister, their other brother is dead. He's got this really shitty, complicated relationship with his mother, who was clearly shitty in many ways. Like, it's clear he had a lot of abuse growing up, and this has led to this weird toxic masculinity thing that he, and I'm like, okay. But then it ends up, it's not even about that, because like, they can't have something that simple in a fucking movie like this. No, it has to be about this, and spoilers for Prince of Tides, I guess. It has to be about this insane thing. They grew up on this house in South Carolina, I think, that they specifically mentioned at some point is on an island that they could only get to town by like taking the boat across the thing. So that is important because the critical tragic thing that happened in his life that he eventually tells her about is that three prisoners escaped from the jail, somehow got to their house on this island, which is never explained whatsoever, and one of them raped his mother, one of them raped his sister, and one of them raped him, some of which we have to watch. Like,
this is like a late in the movie thing that comes, like it had never come up before.
There's it's clear that there's something that like that they haven't talked about like before that. There's some, they mention a word periodically that like they haven't talked about, but like, no, I was not expecting it to be brutal child rape. And it was just and also, why did I have to watch it? It was oh my God, it was so bad. It was so bad, and I'm furious that I have to watch it. And also, I do not think that Barbara Streisand was that good in it either. I don't understand. I don't think she's that good. I just don't think she's that good.
See, I'm trying to think. I must have seen her in some things. I don't have anything that comes immediately to mind of like Barbara Streisand performances that I've seen. I must have seen at least a couple movies that she was in, but nothing comes to mind.
She hasn't been in that many things. The number of people who were like, why didn't Barbara Streisand get to direct more movies? And I'm like, maybe because it's terrible. I don't know. I've seen her in Yentl, Hello Dolly. I guess she was in, The Star is Born and Prince of Tides. That's all I've seen her in. So I don't know. I guess. Yeah,
okay. I mean, I haven't seen any of those, so.
Anyway, so I will stop ranting about how terrible this movie was, but it really was so fucking terrible. And it was 2 hours and 10 minutes because of course it was, it couldn't even be short and fucking terrible. Yesterday we went to go see, or nope, Friday, we went to go see, Love Lies Bleeding.
I was going to see that yesterday, and then it didn't work out. I'm going to see it this afternoon. I've been very excited about it for a while now, but didn't manage to get to it yet.
I enjoyed it so much. I had such a good... There's a lot of things where... I mean, one, it looks incredible. Gorgeous, gorgeous cinematography. Like, just absolutely beautiful. Yeah, I won't say too much because I want you to experience it. I think I am not... I feel like overall, I am not really like an exploitation film type of fan most of the time.
I think I am more and more these days. It's kind of come along with my increasing enjoyment of horror. The two often obviously go hand in hand. So I think I've been more and more appreciative of that kind of stuff over the last few years.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I have not, as I have been going the other way on horror. But I really liked this. I rated it a 4. I'm still playing with a 4.5. I think I might need to watch it again to be sure on that. But there's a core here that somehow makes it work, things work for me that shouldn't have, it felt like. And I just also like two things. One, it's very funny to me, Kristen Stewart, who I genuinely think is a great actor, and this is not a slam on her in any way, I worship the ground Kristen Stewart walks on, but like she has very noticeable like acting tics sometimes, right? Like she has very specific facial expressions and stuff. So it's always very funny to me when I'm watching something that is not Twilight, because I have seen Twilight so many times that like there is a scene in this when she is in a lot of pain. And like the faces and noises that she makes to be in pain are so like they are the faces and noises that she made while she was giving birth in Breaking Dawn. Anyway, it's just very funny to me to be like thinking about Twilight and some of these movies. But also, isn't it wild that as a culture, we just like watched Kristen Stewart walk around for so long and we're like, yep, that's a straight woman. That's what that is. Crazy, crazy. Also, a character in the movie has my name. Is Bethany. It was Beth for most of the movie, and I was like, oh, I hope it's not Bethany, because I don't like, it's always jarring to me. But it just happens so rarely, I feel like.
Yeah, it hardly ever happens to me either, but I wouldn't say that I like it, but it doesn't bother me. I don't know.
In this instance, it did not bother me because there is a moment that is not sexual in the movie, but there is a moment where Kristen Stewart shouted my name and then grabbed the character's face, and I was like, well, you know, that's okay then. Anyway, I really liked it. I'm excited to hear what you think of it. And then Eric and I watched Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom because we had a night to ourselves, and that was one of the things that we have been meaning to. It was dumb. I don't have much to say about it one way or another. This isn't like Prince of Tides where I passionately hated it. This is more just like I've already mostly forgotten that this existed and I watched it 48 hours ago. Are we doing TV? I have like one or two TV things.
Yeah, I can't remember if I have any TV stuff, but yeah, I think I might as well.
Okay, I will not bother getting into Love is Blind because you don't care, but I did start season 2 of Perry Mason, which I know you watched. I have 2 episodes in so far. I don't get alone time that often, but I really liked the first 2 episodes. I think I liked the first 2 episodes of season 2 a lot better than I liked season 1.
I think season 2 works a lot better than season 1 as a whole, from what I recall. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm excited to watch more of that. I also, have you been watching The Regime on Max?
I have not.
Okay, 2 episodes of that out, 3 as of tonight. Kate Winslet, it's fun. I'm enjoying it. And then also, have you watched Shogun?
I've watched the first episode. I'm not watching it by myself, so I haven't had the opportunity to watch more. But I enjoyed the first episode. I thought it was, you know, I like it when TV shows go that all out. They clearly dumped money into this thing, you know, it's an interesting historical period. So I'm excited to get more into it, but I've only seen 1 episode.
We've only seen 2, but I'm really, really liking it. So it's beautiful. Also, like, what a fun time. Imagine, like, you can watch it dubbed, but, like, I think it's a really interesting choice to make only the Japanese in Japanese and to make all the other languages just English. I like it. Honestly, I like it. Two, imagine a world like 10 or 15 years ago where we had a show that was fully half in Japanese or whatever that was just airing on, like, I love it. I love it.
Well, and we just had the Monarch show had lengthy section. I mean, a lot of it was set in Japan. It had a lot of Japanese dialogue. In fact, the actress in Shogun was I don't remember her name, and it took me, I was like halfway into the episode before I figured out that was who it was, but she shows up in Shogun as well. And I really liked her in Monarch. I thought she was really good. So I was glad to see her again, but.
Yeah. She is great. We are still watching Monarch. We have 3 episodes left. We've been watching it very slowly.
I don't even remember if I ended up talking about my overall thoughts on that, but I did enjoy it. I would definitely watch more of it.
I think you did. Anyway, we're kind of watching it in tandem with I know we don't need to have seen it all by the time the new Godzilla Kong, but it's just like a convenient end date. So we're watching that, and that's been really good. Morgan and I are rewatching we're a little over halfway through season 2 of Reservation Dogs. Morgan had never seen it before, so, and then I'll finally get to see season 3. We just watched the episode last night that had, Amber,
Mid Thunder.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. That was one of the best, like, of the sort of, I don't know if cameo is the right word, but guest starring appearances. Yeah.
Thanking our reptilian ancestors. Anyway,
I watched that like the day after I watched Prey too. And she's so good in that, and like could not be more opposite characters. Yeah, it was great.
Fabulous. So we've been watching that and still working on Buffy and Angel, which is like just such an interesting. It's such an interesting experience. Like Buffy, I still know almost every beat most of the time. Like I watched it so many times, but Angel, which I did see several times, and it's not like there's ever been anything that's come up that I'm like, I didn't remember that happened at all, but it's not infrequent that it comes up where I'm like, I don't remember this is happening until it is happening. And there was an episode that we watched the other night where Angel's cop friend, Kate, because all private detectives need a cop friend, which, like, fine, whatever, that's part of the genre, but where Kate, like, manages to arrest this, like, big mobster guy or whatever, and this guy's lawyers are Wolfram and Hart, who are the, you know, the evil lawyer people in the show, and they hatch a plan to break him out of jail, which is
giving the cops magical sensitivity training that puts them too much in their feelings, and then they can't be cops anymore.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
There are parts of it that work better than others. There is one part that is extremely funny, but I think not for the reason that it was supposed to be funny then, where, like, all of the cops are, like, yelling therapy speak at each other, essentially. Like, you've made me feel unsafe or whatever. And it's really, like, I think at the time it was just supposed to be funny because it was like, ooh, feelings words. And now it's just funny because that is actually what abusive people do with therapy language. So there's stuff like that that comes up that you're just like, wow, this sure was the early 2000s, wasn't it? Also, we did think that Joss Whedon was a social justice hero. What a fun thing for us to have thought. But there's also a lot. I mean, like, Cordelia, like, Charisma Carpenter, just, it is, like, truly, of all the things I hold against Joss Whedon, and there are a number, his, like, fucking with her career and, like, so much is like it. She was so good. She was just so good. And her and Angel, like, the reason Angel works is because Cordelia and Angel together in the first few seasons are so funny. Like, her just like vibes versus his, like, dark and broody vibes. Just, like, very good. Anyway, I am still very much enjoying the rewatch. But yeah, there are times where you're just like, oh gosh, well, which I imagine will be true with any show from that time. But yeah, so that's that. That's what I got.
Quick side note, I don't know if you were aware of this or had looked it up yourself, but did you see how many Academy Award nominations The Prince of Tides received?
No.
7, including Best Picture. Didn't win anything, but it was clearly not. I don't think her lack of directorial options after that was because the movie wasn't well received.
I know, and I understand that probably the fact that she didn't direct more movies is largely, well, several things. I think Babs is sort of notoriously awful to work with. Like, people do not, she is like a drama queen that people do not enjoy working with. Did you know, Ezra was telling me the other day, apparently Barbara Streisand is the reason that wireless mics became the standard on Broadway.
I feel like I have heard that story before, yeah, yeah.
Which Ezra, as a sound person, is not thrilled about because things go wrong more. Anyway, no, I mean, of course the fact that she was a woman is like obviously many men have made just as bad or worse movies and have gotten to keep making them. But, like, also, maybe we should champion women who are good at it. Just a wild fucking thought.
Maybe the moral here is that it's a good thing that she didn't. Yeah, anyway. Okay. So I'm going to go a little out of order on mine because I have. So people who have been listening for a long time may recall a couple years ago me talking a lot. I was doing a lot of horror movies in part because I was listening to a podcast called The Evolution of Horror, which did seasons that went through like subgenres of horror, and, you know, they kind of went through the history of, like, the whole subgenre. And the second season was about ghost movies, and I got towards the end of that season and hit a big cluster of movies that were just not available anywhere. Could not find them, couldn't watch them anywhere, so I just kind of dropped it, and I hadn't been listening, I hadn't been going through the podcast anymore. But recently, there were three that were not available anywhere, but two of them recently became available. So I went ahead and there's one that's called The Entity that is it is not streaming anywhere in the world, apparently, and not available on Blu-ray. And but at any rate, the ones I did watch from 1992. Have you ever heard of Ghost Watch?
I don't think so.
So I was not familiar with this either. It was a British television production that was done. It was almost like a War of the Worlds type thing. It was presented as a live television special that was an investigation of a haunted house.
I heard This American Life that talked about this.
That makes sense. And they used actual, like, well-known television presenters who would do like news programs and, like, nonfiction stuff. They presented it as live. It wasn't actually live. They filmed it all a couple weeks beforehand, but they presented it as live, and they had. A presenter and, like, a psychic in studio talking about stuff. And then they had an on-site reporter who was going to spend the night in the house with this family who'd been experiencing this haunting. And then they had a guy outside who was, like, kind of the comic relief who was, like, going around interviewing the neighbors. He was the guy what was that British sci-fi comedy show with the two guys on the spaceship, Red Dwarf. He was one of the guys from that. Apparently he was also, like, a TV presenter. He did that kind of stuff. I had never seen him in anything besides Red Dwarf, but at any rate, he's in this. And they have like a phone number that they're giving out for people to call in with their haunting experiences and stuff. And like, and apparently it was broadcast during a time slot for a program that did fictional stuff. And they had credited writers at the beginning of it. But of course, most people don't watch television by sitting down at the start time and watching through. People flip channels and they come across it or whatever. So they ended up getting besieged by phone calls demand because obviously they're investigating this haunted house, and obviously things start going wrong, shadows start appearing, you know, and it's really good. And but it's interesting to watch it now, because watching it now, it's a completely different thing than it was made to be, right? It was made to be this live production that people would experience. But watching it now, it's essentially a found footage movie, but that is not really what it would have been then, but that's how it plays now. But in part because, of course, I don't know who any of these presenters are, but they were all people that everyone watching it then would have known who they were. And like the woman that they had staying in the house was apparently best known for doing like children's television, doing presentations about that. And so she's in there like, it's a single mother with two daughters. So she's in there like playing with the girls and stuff and like...
Yeah, I think This American Life dedicated an entire episode to this. I didn't know you could watch it anywhere.
It is now streaming on, I think I watched it on Amazon.
Okay.
But that was, it was not available anywhere, and apparently it's never been rebroadcast. I kept seeing it referred to as a mockumentary, which felt very strange to me because I think of that term associated specifically with comedies, like a funny fake documentary. And it is not that at all. But I guess it's the accurate term because it's like set made like a documentary, but obviously it's all fake. So I guess technically it is a mockumentary, but that doesn't feel like the right term for it. But found footage horror was not a thing at the time, right? So no one would have had that term. But it's really well done. It's clearly like... You know, there's no like big flashy effects in it or anything. It's all very like sort of grounded, low budget stuff, but it's creepy. And like there's some really cool touches, like there's a guy in the studio who's like in charge of the phone banks. So they're like there's like eight people taking calls and he's kind of collating them all and passing along the relevant ones. He was apparently in real life married to the woman who was doing the report from the house. And this was like, they were both TV presenters and they were married to each other. So like everyone knew them as like a couple. So you have this dynamic where like she's in the house and ends up being like in peril from this ghost that's happening. And he's stuck in the studio. There's just a lot of like really cool, good touches to it. And it plays out very slowly because of, you know, it's supposed to be like this all-night broadcast thing, and of course nothing happens for the first several hours, right? So like it takes a long time for anything to happen, but it's just really well done. I really enjoyed it. I was really glad I watched it, and it is a sort of fascinating piece of history. Very like Blair Witch, Paranormal Activity, obviously, are sort of in the same lineage. I definitely I recommend it. It's a really interesting thing.
No, that's cool. I like I said, I think when I listened to the podcast, it wasn't available then, maybe. So yeah, I would like to see it. That's really cool.
So another thing that I watched for that is another British TV thing that had not been available streaming anywhere, which you can now rent on Amazon. That was how I watched it. It's the 1989 The Woman in Black, which there was a... like, I don't know, 2010 or something, Woman in Black adaptation with Daniel Radcliffe that we watched.
That I hated so much.
I remember liking it, but I haven't watched it since then. It's been a long time. But this, I guess this is, it's based on a novel that was like a pretty big deal and is still like, it's in like British like school curriculum and stuff. Like everyone reads this book and there is like a very famous play of it that I guess is like the second longest running play in the UK after The Mousetrap. And so like everyone goes to see it on school trips when they're a kid or whatever. But then there was this TV adaptation of it in 1989, which is also like, it's really good. It's really well made. It has the main star of it is the guy who played James Potter in the Harry Potter movies, which is just, obviously he's barely in those movies. But he plays this young lawyer who goes this woman who is the who was a client of his law firm dies, and he gets sent out to this like sort of remote estate of hers to go through her paperwork and attend her funeral and stuff. And they did you ever watch that that HBO miniseries, The Third Day, with Jude Law, that kind of folk horror thing?
Yeah, we talked about it on here.
Okay, well, I couldn't remember if you'd watched it. I loved that thing, but that is all set on OC Island, and there's the whole thing with the like, what do you call it? The land bridge that you can only cross at low tide. I can't think of the word, but they shot this is. It's not set on OC, but it's supposed to be set on this island that's a similar thing where you can only get to it. And they, I think Causeway, it's a causeway. They use the same causeway to film the stuff, which I thought was, like, I saw it show up there. I was like, I wonder if that's the same one. And so I Googled it and it was. But anyway, of course, he gets out to the house and there's creepy stuff. He sees this woman standing in the back of the funeral and tries to call people's attention to it. And, like, no one wants to acknowledge it. And it eventually, you know, there's this sort of, like, long-standing haunting by this woman in black who every time she shows up a child dies, just a random child basically. And it's really good. It's very well done, very creepy. And then the other one I watched also for this, because of this podcast, is the 2016 Iranian horror movie Under the Shadow, which that one's been available for a while. It's on Netflix.
I think I watched it with Eric a couple of years ago.
I didn't like it nearly as much as I was hoping to.
Same.
I'd heard a lot of really good things about it when it came out. And there's definitely interesting stuff there. But I don't know. It's set during the Iran-Iraq War, which I don't really know anything about. But it's this woman living with her daughter and her husband in this city that's kind of under constant bombardment. And her husband gets drafted and leaves to go help in the war effort, and so she's stuck in this apartment with her daughter, and her daughter is, you know, seeing things, and it's like there's some kind of creepy moments, but I don't know, I didn't find it. A lot of people compared it to The Babadook, which it has similar thematic stuff going on, but it's not as interesting. Or The Babadook did a lot of like really cool stuff with what was clearly like very low budget effects, and I think this movie kind of reached for similar things, but there's just nothing as visually interesting going on here. I don't know. I was kind of disappointed by it overall. Okay, so that's the three things I watched for that. The Pickford Theater last weekend played Pink Flamingos, which I think you had mentioned you might go see. You didn't end up being there. I didn't see you.
We had talked about going, but that was the day that we watched all of the short films, and we were pretty exhausted by the end of the day.
Okay, so 1972, John Waters, sort of infamous gross out movie Pink Flamingos, with one of several partnerships that he did with Divine. I had never seen any of those. I've seen a handful of John Waters movies, but I'd never seen any of his older stuff. I mean, I guess most.
I believe Pink Flamingos is in the 1001 movies you must see before you die. So yeah, we've talked about that.
So it's been one of those movies for a long time for me, because it's like in that book and stuff. It's like, I know I'm going to watch it one of these days, but it's never been like a high priority for me. I always kind of slightly dreaded it, and I kind of figured I would sort of leave it till the end. But then it was playing at the theater, and it's like, I should go see it. I really liked it. It's cool. Really funny. Like, there's definitely some like serious cringe, like, I would rather not be looking at this moments, but I laughed through most of it. And I think seeing it in a theater, it was like a pretty, like, probably like three quarters full house, which, and everyone was really into it. So it was like a really good atmosphere for it. But there's like a narrator that pops up four or five times in the movie who was so funny that every time the narrator came on, I ended up missing part of what he said because I was laughing so hard. Like, it was miles funnier than I was expecting it to be. Like, I didn't really know what to expect. It has the famous scene where Divine eats dog shit off the sidewalk. That is the thing that people talk about. That's the thing that everyone knows from it. That is the final shot of the movie. So if you want to watch it and don't want to see that, you can turn it off 30 seconds early and you don't have to see it. But, It's really funny. Like, it's clearly like crazy low budget, and it's just like John Waters and his crazy drugged out friends having a good time. And it's fun. There's some stuff that's like maybe a little bit, the whole plot is that Divine is this person who had been named by the media as like the, I can't remember the exact wording, but basically like the grossest person alive or something like that. Not grossest. That wasn't the word they used, but I can't remember what it was. And there's this other, this couple who have heard about this and are outraged because they believe that they should have that title. And so they set out to prove that they deserve that title. And there's this whole thing with them, like they run a baby adoption ring, and they have like kidnapped women living in their basement who they're impregnating and then adopting out their babies, which is all like pretty dark, obviously, and it doesn't, like, they don't quite hit the tonal balance, I think, to anyway. But
the filthiest person alive.
That's really. It. Yeah, the filthiest person alive. Yeah. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. I liked it so much more than I thought I would. I was definitely glad I saw it that way. Yeah, I mean, it is like sort of the epitome of a not for everyone kind of movie, but I thought it was really funny.
Cool. Yeah. No, I mean, I wish we'd been able to make it, because it did seem like if we were going to watch it, that would be like the ideal way to watch it. But I was so tired.
Okay. I've only got a couple other things here. Do you know Taylor Tomlinson? Are you familiar with her stand-up comic?
I have seen clips of her on TikTok. She's never particularly impressed me, so I've never watched her. Okay.
I've seen it. She's been like big rising star in comedy. I think she's had like 3 or 4 specials now, even though she's only like 30 years old. And I've been, yeah, I see her stuff on Instagram Reels all the time and stuff. I've always thought she was pretty funny, and she has a lot of like, she also grew up in like a very evangelical circle and has a lot of her materials about that.
I think the one joke by her that I did like that several people ended up sending to me was how weird it is to have people convert to religion when you're an adult, when you grew up with it. Yeah, I remember finding that funny.
Anyway, she has a new special on Netflix called Have It All that I watched that I very much enjoyed. But if you haven't really been into her stuff, then I don't know that it's not necessarily worth checking out for you. But I think she's pretty funny. I enjoyed it. And then just by weird coincidence here, I watched a John McTiernan movie. I just had a couple hours and was looking for something to watch, and I ended up watching The Hunt for Red October, which I've been thinking about rewatching for a while because I have also been watching through 30 Rock. I started doing that while I was homesick and ended up just like, last time I talked about, I had watched a ton of movies, but I also blasted through like 5 seasons of 30 Rock. I was 6. I've been seeing Alec Baldwin a lot. And Hunt for Red October was the first thing I ever saw him in. So I still always think about that. I fucking love The Hunt for Red October, man. It was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. I watched it a lot, and it was definitely one of those where it's like, I wasn't sure how I would feel about it now. I haven't seen it since I was probably like 18 or 19. It's so fucking good. Like the McTiernan and is it Yann DeBont, I think his cinematographer, who like they worked together on Die Hard and Predator, and it's just a great team. It all looks fantastic. I really like submarine movies, I think probably in large part because of this movie. This is probably the first one I saw, and I know that's not your thing. But it all just works together so well. There's all these, like, the movie is just packed with, like, minor characters who only have, like, 1 or 2 scenes, but they're, like, really compelling and interesting and well-played, and, like, I went nuts. I actually raised my rating of it after watching it again. So that was a big relief. Like I said, I wasn't totally sure what I would think of it, but I was.
I think I saw it once. Like, I think one time ever, probably when I was like 15. I have not rewatched it.
It was definitely one of those movies that we watched with Dad a lot, because it is sort of like a quintessential dad movie in a lot of ways.
Yes, but I didn't watch this movie.
Right. No, I know. I get that. But that was part of why I saw it so much. But it also has Sam Neill in it, who I've been getting more and more into Sam Neill as an actor over the last few years. He's really good. He picks interesting stuff.
Also, he hangs out on his weird little ranch and hangs out with pigs and like does weird TikToks playing guitar and shit.
Yeah, yeah. It also had Stellan Skarsgård in a small role, which I did not remember. I remembered the character, but I did not remember that was who was playing him. He's just like, he's like a bad guy Russian captain who is in this like very dramatically lit submarine, and he's just like sweaty and smoking cigarettes the whole time. It's very entertaining. What was the other thing I was going to mention?
I'm currently imagining how awful it would be to be in a submarine where people were smoking. Jesus Christ.
I know, but a lot of characters do in this, yeah, which I don't know what kind of rules they had around that, if any. But yeah, right, because they could only even ventilate when they go to the surface, which obviously they're not doing very often. So I know, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, but there was something. So this is what I was going to mention. Do you remember how that movie dealt with the language thing?
Shit, so you say that and I feel like I do, but I don't remember.
It's very distinctive. So the first couple sequences, we have Sean Connery playing a Russian captain, right? The first, like, sort of introductory stuff, he's speaking Russian, and all of the Russians are speaking Russian. And then we get this scene where he goes in and he's talking to this guy, and this guy is reading a passage of a thing. And while he's reading, the camera zooms in on his mouth, and mid-sentence he switches to English. It zooms back out. And then the rest of the movie, they speak English to each other.
I do.
Something else in the last couple of years did exactly this same trick, and I can't remember what it was. It's been driving me nuts. There was some, I don't remember if it was a movie or a TV thing, but there was something else that did it the exact same way, and I can't remember what it was. Anyway, yeah, I love that movie. I will watch that movie many more times in my life, I think. Scott Glenn is in it, who I always really like, and he's one of the fun things about it is Alec Baldwin's character is just like, constantly in over his head. He's like this low-level CIA guy who gets thrown into this crazy situation, and everyone around him knows that he's in over his head, and they're just like rolling their eyes at him the whole time. But of course he's right about everything, but he's also like has no idea what he's doing, and everyone around him is way more competent than he is. And yeah, it's really good. I liked it so much. I think that's the last movie. Yeah, that's the last movie I had. I'm trying to think if I've had any other TV stuff, but I don't think I have. I haven't really found something else to watch since I finished Fargo. So I'm still rewatching through 30 Rock, although the quality of that has dipped by the sixth season. Like, it's still kind of funny, but it's not what it was in the early seasons.
Do you want recommendations? 'Cause I bet I have some.
I'm sure you do. Maybe we can talk about that, but, yeah, I don't know. I'll land on something eventually, but, I always have like half a dozen things that are on my like mental list of like, I would like to watch that. And then one time when I'm looking, I'll come across it and I'll start. And I really should just keep an actual list probably. But yeah, I think that's all I've got.
All right, cool. Well, I don't know when this will come out. Oh, a few days, a week, who can say? But regardless, the next time we talk, we will talk about Dead Man Walking and about the death penalty, and that'll be cheerful and enjoyable to do. So,
I am looking forward to watching that movie again. I'm very curious to see how it'll land now, but I could definitely see it going either way. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. Well, we will talk to everyone then. Bye, y'all.
Bye, everyone.